Today is February 12th, 2014, and this is episode number 242, Still Not a Palindrome, of the Apple Context Machine, a podcast for the Mac Observer. I'm Jeff Gamet, managing editor at TMO.
And I'm Brian Chaffin, palindrome. To get the full story on anything we cover in this podcast, you can visit macobserver.com/ACM. And if you would like to comment on or question anything about this show, shoot us a note at acm@macobserver.com.
And that's all for this week. Wait. Oh, I always get that part wrong.
Well, I figure, you know, I am the same thing forwards and backwards, so I must be a palindrome. Plus, I forgot to think of a title.
That's all right. I think we covered, no one will ever know.
That's true. That is true. Now, any new listeners may not understand why 242 is not a palindrome.
Well, it's easy because numbers can't be palindromes. Only words can.
Yes.
But that isn't where you were going, is it?
No, that's exactly where I was going.
Oh,
okay. You explained this the last time we talked about it, but that was like...
I did. That was on probably...
Episode 131 or something.
A long something time like ago.
I think we recorded that one back in 2002.
Yeah, right at the end of the... of the KT event. Yeah.
KT event?
That's when the comet hit Earth and
nicely
killed the dinosaurs.
Played, sir. Nicely played. I wish I was cool enough to have been able to follow, but I'm not.
Me too. I really wish you were cool enough to follow.
I know, and I'm not. It's really, really sad. Boy, a lame title. I missed the KT event. Joke.
You know, it's a good thing you missed the KT event.
Yeah.
It was a really rough day.
Fair enough. Now, speaking of rough days, I couldn't keep a straight face on that. Actually, speaking of rough days, let's go to Twitter where Nick Betcher, what do you think? Bit.
Sure.
Well, his name is Nick Bit, so maybe it's Bitcher. B-O-E-T-T-C-H-E-R.
Maybe he just likes doing the kind of play on words, and it's really Betcher, but he goes by Nick Bit.
Yeah, or he could be a coder. We don't know, but he is a listener, and we appreciate that. And he asked us, as part of a conversation, was this the last week's episode, right? We talked about
mm-hmm.
Microsoft?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
He said, how is Microsoft designing for its needs... any different from every other company, including Apple? And answering that in 144 characters or less was kind of hard. So I thought we would bring that to the show and actually just talk about it.
I think that sounds like an excellent plan.
Okay, well, let's do it.
And thank you for the comment.
Indeed. Yeah. Our Microsoft thing got a little bit of conversation going, and that's always fun. We appreciate it. Toby Pender was also a part of that conversation, by the way.
Yeah.
So, here's the deal with the Microsoft. Apple is certainly a company. Here's the deal with Microsoft. Apple is certainly a company. That's just ridiculous. But
I'm just sitting back. I can't wait to see how you work your way out of this.
I know. Let me get the shovel. Apple is... obviously, a company that designs products around its own strategies. And to that extent, within that frame, certainly to its own needs. For instance, the iPhone being a closed system is what Apple thinks is not only in its best interest, but it's also designing that product for what people want. And that is part of the difference. But with Microsoft, we have a company that never seems to have any interest in what its customers want.
I think that's a huge thing right there. I think for Microsoft, it's about creating a product that serves their specific need, which is gaining market share, And there's a secondary need, which is catering to partners, business partners. And that does not include providing a product or service that meets a customer's need. So they're looking at two levels of needs right there before they even get to a level where they might consider customers.
Before they even come close to looking at what the customer wants. And I would even say, I'd use a different word than catering. Sometimes it's even pandering. To wit, let's go back to the Windows XP days. And when that OS was being introduced, and it included all sorts of anti-copying controls that served the needs of content owners while not serving the needs of the customers that were actually buying the product.
That's true. Yeah, do you remember when Microsoft had to deal with the egg on the face of having Windows lock users out because it decided that they were no longer running valid licenses when they were?
Yeah, that is another fine example where they have put onerous. But see, that, you know, that's not so much that's not designing a product. What am I trying to say?
You're exactly right. That's not designing a product. That's just throwing crap together.
That's not designing. That's not like inventing a product based on their needs. That's taking a product and tacking on something that serves their needs. But Apple certainly also does things with its Apple has kicked numerous apps out of the App Store because they duplicated functionality of Apple's own software. That's actually pretty analogous, I think, to the completely onerous copy controls that Microsoft has built in for Office and Windows.
That feels like a little bit of a stretch to me, but I'll go with it.
Because
it is a nice example.
They're both self-serving. Yes. and don't help the customers in any way.
Yes, I will totally agree with that.
And cut to the initial kerfuffle over the new Xbox device that was initially supposed to be online all the time, or it wouldn't function. That benefits Microsoft and has nothing to do with customers. You know, Microsoft approached this from the standpoint of what do we want this gaming device to do? Well, we want it online all the time so that we get reports on what people are doing and, you know, how much time they're spending on it and, you know, what they're watching, what they're playing, etc.
Right. It also gives them incredible control over end user licenses.
Yes, absolutely. And then cut to Windows 8. Windows 8 is the ultimate example of all this, where Windows 8 was designed around Microsoft's need to perpetuate Windows, to continue the Windows legacy, to continue making money with Windows, to continue having Windows be relevant in an age of mobile devices. This is the ultimate example of that. Microsoft designed Windows 8 around its perceived need to continue selling Windows and for Windows to still be a thing that anybody cares about.
Yeah, now contrast that with Apple and the way that they have evolved their operating systems. And yes, there have been big stumbling points along the way. But instead of perpetuating OS X, when they brought out the iPhone and the iPad and iPod Touch, they created a different operating system.
Yeah, they were willing to kill OS X with iOS.
And luckily, that didn't happen, but, it could have.
They were willing to kill the iPod with the iPhone.
Oh, definitely.
They're willing to kill sales of Macs with the iPad. Again, fortunately, in my opinion, fortunately, that hasn't happened. But they were willing to do it.
Right. And in the end, what they saw was a better system for their users, which ultimately translates into more sales.
Right. Look at the iPad. When Apple announced the iPad, I think it may be hard to remember this because of the way we quickly adapted to the iPad. But when Apple announced the iPad, and when Apple released the iPad, we didn't really know how we were going to use it.
That's true. It was just this magic-looking glass and metal slab
that we couldn't wait to get our hands on.
We really couldn't wait to get our hands on
it. And before it was released, I remember doing a presentation at CatMac in Austin, Texas. That's the Mac user group run by my mother, Nancy Gravely, who, by the way, is recovering from some surgery. If anybody wants to send her some well wishes, please, please do.
Yes, Nancy's awesome. Send her your virtual hugs and happiness.
Yes, please do. I did a presentation before the iPad was released. I want to say it was released in April, right? Like April 10th or something?
That sounds about right, yeah.
And so it must have been in March. Yeah, it was in March. Of course it was in March. And I remember specifically saying, we don't know what we're going to do with this thing yet. Apple doesn't even know what we're going to do with this thing yet. You know, the App Store was still relatively new. The iBooks wasn't necessarily a thing. You know, we didn't have any dedicated iPad apps. Anyway, the point is this. Apple wasn't sure exactly how the iPad was going to be used, but they released it because they thought that people would adapt to it and want it, and they did. Look at Surface. Contrast that with Surface. Surface was designed to, again, perpetuate the Windows legacy, perpetuate
and grab market share.
The Office legacy, and to grab market share, and that failed utterly. Actually, all of it failed. It's just a complete failure.
Yeah, well, it was just the next Zune.
And it was designed to be this hybrid device because Microsoft felt that hybrid devices were important to perpetuating this Windows legacy. I mean, it was designed to meet all of Microsoft's goals, not to meet a customer's needs, not even just to see what customers would do with it. It was designed to meet Microsoft's goals, and that's the difference between Google. Here, Google has a business model that I don't like. Google's business model is to spy on everything that I do, develop profiles that know me better than I know myself, and then sell that information to advertisers. Right? I don't like that, but I like Google's products. And when Google is developing products and releases products, yes, those products tend to fit within their overall strategy of knowing more about us, but those products themselves are always designed for us, the user. They're designed for us to want to use them.
Yeah, Google Now is a perfect example. Very creepy, but designed in a way to make us want to use it, and it actually provides a useful service.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, you know, so as many problems as I have with Google, they're not Microsoft. As a matter of fact, Microsoft is just you know, poster child for how to do this stuff wrong. But anyway, that's the difference in my opinion. That's the difference between Microsoft and many other companies, including Apple.
I agree. It's for some people, it's a very subtle philosophical difference. But in practice, it's actually a really big thing, and it shows. I mean, look at what Apple has on the market today, and how these products came to be, and look at what Microsoft has on the market today, and how those products came to be, and it's very different.
Here's another example of a company that designs for its own uses. This would be the content industry. You know, the content industry spent a lot of effort trying to build copy controls into CDs. not because it was for the customer's benefit, but because it was to their benefit. Universal and who all is behind Hulu? Is it Universal?
Universal, NBC. I think Sony's involved.
Maybe.
Or they were involved but aren't anymore.
There's a product, one way or another, the content owners that put Hulu together,
Fox.
They developed Hulu to serve up content in a way that the content owners liked, not in the way that we like.
How about Ultraviolet? Same thing. That wasn't designed to fit consumers' needs. That was exclusively for content providers.
Yes, absolutely.
And it's a crap technology.
And contrast that with Netflix. Here's a company that clearly is designing its product for what consumers want.
That's an excellent contrast.
Yeah, so, I mean, you know, Microsoft isn't alone, but in the technology world, I think that they are the king of this. And it's why I don't respect the company. And it's why I think that Satya, by the way, his name, it turns out, is pronounced Satya.
Oh, and all last week you were telling me how to pronounce his name wrong. No wonder I couldn't get it right.
I know. We were both wrong last week.
Satya.
Satya. Yeah, it's Satya.
I can remember that. Satya.
Satya Nadella. So, you know, it's Satya Nadella needs to be willing to break this particular mold if Microsoft is going to be relevant going forward.
I hope he can.
He can.
I'm concerned that I don't have any basis for this other than he's worked at Microsoft for so long, but I'm concerned that because he's worked for Microsoft so long, the way things have always been is so ingrained in him that they will continue to operate in the same fashion.
Probably.
I hope I'm wrong.
Yeah, so do I. You're not. We're not. It's going to be a big failure. Microsoft is in for an eventual slow decline. There you have
it. That's unfortunate.
Shall we move on?
Yeah, let's move on, because I'm going to start getting sad if we don't.
Well, I have some more sad for you. Let's talk about...
Perfect.
Exactly, right? Yay, me! Let's talk about the appeals court. Apple and the antitrust monitor.
Okay, it's sad, but it's not as sad as it could have been.
No, it actually... So what happened is the appeals court rejected Apple's request that our motion is a better term for it, that the antitrust monitor installed by Judge Denise Coate be delayed permanently until Apple's broader appeal over its conviction has been heard.
Yeah, so he still gets to perform a very well-defined set of functions. Yeah,
he actually gets to go back on the job because there was a temporary stay that had been issued by a single judge until Tuesday's ruling.
Right. And, so he gets to go back on the job, but now he has much stricter guidelines that he has to operate under.
Yeah, and what's, you know, it's kind of interesting to me, the DOJ, so, you know, Apple argued in front of the appellate court, and the DOJ argued in front of the appellate court, and the DOJ was saying that he already has limitations. And Apple...
Right.
And the guy was
He can't fly. He can't walk through walls.
Well, they were saying, his limitations are already spelled out. It's all supposed to be, you know, about... it's all supposed to be about monitoring Apple's antitrust compliance. And, of course, one of the problems for Apple is that he was acting well outside of that. He was demanding interviews with everybody.
You know? Right. And Judge Coate seemed to be okay with that.
Yes. She did, in fact, seem to be entirely okay with that. And so what the appellate judges did is so here's the deal. The DOJ was lying. Those limitations were not spelled out. But the appellate court effectively took the DOJ at its word, but then said, and so shall it be. So I find that part of the process kind of interesting.
It is interesting, and it kind of perpetuates the notion that this was all set before the trial even began. Like everyone knew exactly what they wanted, and so that's just what it was going to be.
Well, what do you mean?
Meaning that the DOJ knew they wanted to have Apple convicted of antitrust. Judge Coates knew that she was going to convict Apple of that and put the monitor in place. And now you have the appeals court essentially backing that up. Now, I know that in reality, this is not a case of a kangaroo court, but at times with the way this plays out, it sure can feel that way.
Yeah, maybe. I'm actually not going to go that far. I think that Judge Coates wrong, but
well, I think she's wrong too.
But I don't feel like it was a kangaroo court. I believe that
no,
she's
it
made
definitely
an error.
Wasn't. It's just at times it feels that way to me.
And I don't even feel. I feel like the appellate court listened to Apple's arguments, and that they just didn't. They didn't feel like Apple's arguments were good enough.
I just figured out what the problem is for me. This is like therapy for me. Oh my God, Brian, we just had a big breakthrough for
Excellent.
Me. It's frustration, and it's my frustration that's manifesting itself from my belief that Judge Coates ruled improperly in this case. And as everything has moved forward, we have not yet seen something that validates Apple as being correct in their continued assertion that they've done nothing wrong. And so that's where the frustration is coming from, and it's manifesting itself as me saying through me saying things like, it feels like a kangaroo court.
I see. Well, how about this? How about speaking of kangaroo courts? Where will I go?
You know, I know what we're talking about today, and yet I have no idea where we're about to go.
Let's talk about the new Apple TV rumor from Bloomberg.
I see. I so didn't see you going there.
Completely well, non sequiturs.
It's everyone that's listening along. You sitting there being completely baffled about where we end up next. I'm totally with you.
And Jeff has a list.
And I have the list.
So yeah. Bloomberg reported today that Apple is working on a new version of an Apple TV set-top box with a faster processor.
But wait, there's more.
The leaks, they didn't say this, but to me the writing is pretty clear. The writing between the lines is pretty clear. They said that Apple is in negotiations with Time Warner over some content licensing for this new set-top box. And the implication is that the leak that their sources came from with either within Time Warner itself or some party that's associated with Time Warner, basically on the TV side of things. And the other thing that this Apple TV is going to have is a new and improved interface for navigating between your TV shows, your movies, and your other video content.
So this could, in essence, become the One Box as opposed to the One Ring.
It could be, which invokes for the first time in a rumor, Steve Jobs's I finally cracked it comment, referring to how to do a connected TV interface that actually works.
And this totally plays into my belief that Apple's next big thing in the television market is not a television and won't be.
This would definitely back that up. It doesn't actually exclude a TV, but there's nothing about a TV in the story. And certainly the emphasis is all on a new Apple TV set-top box.
Right, which to me makes much more sense than making a television. And I know I am very much in a minority in that belief, which is okay. I got to be me.
I don't know that you're in the minority.
Okay, in certain circles, I'm in the minority.
Fair enough. You're a havesie with me because I, for a long time, I thought that Apple would do a television set because I thought that a television set would move the revenue on needles. Move the needle on revenues. the revenue on needles. The Apple needle. Simple. Elegant. Sharp. Pointy. It's a little tiny Apple logo engraved with a completely new...
chamfered edges.
Etching system that they developed just for the Apple needle.
And Johnny Ive will sit there in a video with a white background. He'll say, it's absolutely beautiful. And
the eye of this needle is such that you can actually thread it with just one hand. And, you know, you've never threaded a needle like this. And I look at this eye of this needle and it's completely beautiful. It's, you know, it's exactly what I want in the eye of a needle.
And to go along with it, we've made this beautiful line of accessories, the eye thread.
The eye thread. Made out of the best materials, of course.
That's right. Oh my God, this is why they hired the one guy from Nike that knows fabrics. It's so he can design the special weave of the eye threads.
It's sapphire thread, dude.
Oh my God, they figured out a way to sell
sapphire and make it flexible enough to turn into the strongest thread you've ever seen, all to go with the eye needle.
And I'm picturing the lines outside the Apple store. There's all these guys standing there with their girlfriends beside them, and the girlfriends are like, I don't know what we're in line for this time.
But right behind them is the quilting group.
And the quilting group is behind them. And the guys are like, it's eye needle and eye thread. And their dates are with them, and they're like, but you don't sew. I do now.
I love it. All right, so... I thought that Apple would do a TV in order to move the needle on revenues. I'm less confident in that prediction today, much less confident in that prediction. I'm probably even wrong, which is, you know, it's kind of weird. Those are difficult syllables for me to get out all in one stretch. I'm
really glad that we have chairs in the sound studio.
Yeah, and it's been recorded too. Good Lord. I'm doomed. But nonetheless, I think this is neat. I'm excited about this new rumor. Bloomberg, whom I respect immensely, I think that they are one of the best news organizations, especially on the business front, on the planet currently. And they sourced it with two different sources. So I think that the chances that Apple is shopping a new Apple TV set-top box to Time Warner is at 99 or 100%.
I'm well over 90% on my belief in that. And it totally fits with the two avenues that Apple really had open for improving the next version of Apple TV. One is to add in enough features to make it a true gaming console. And the other is to swing deals to make it the set-top box option for other content providers like Time Warner.
Yeah, Time Warner, Comcast, DirecTV, even Dish. They would need to be a player with most of those folks to do it. And this would kind of be like TiVo. You know, DirecTV lets TiVo take over their interface, which is a good thing because DirecTV
can't make an interface to save their lives.
Yeah, it's better than the cable interfaces that I've worked with, but it's nowhere near as good as a TiVo interface. But, you know, the question, of course, would be how does DVR services, if they're going to actually be the interface for Time Warner Cable, they've got to be able to offer DVR services as well. This can't be an Apple only. This can't be like, you know, here's what you get from Time Warner, and then if you want to rent movies, or, you know, or if you want to be able to watch TV shows, you have to rent them from us. That won't fly.
You know, it could be, instead of a DVR function, it could be an on-demand function.
If it was an on-demand function that mirrored DVR services, that is a possibility. But, you know, there's buff. I don't know. So we may actually find out. We may find out this year. This may be the year of both the iWatch and the Apple TV. According to the rumor, Apple could announce the set-top box as early as April for release as late as the holidays. By the holidays, certainly.
That's the part of the rumor that I have a problem with. I don't see Apple announcing a product that far in advance.
Yeah, Apple would need to do that. Well, okay. As soon as the deal with Time Warner gets inked, it's gonna be leaked.
That's true.
Right? So
is Time Warner going to ink a deal that far in advance?
Well, yeah, they'd have to. I mean, for this kind of thing, you need some lead time. And remember,
you do need lead time, but I don't think you need most of a year.
Well, that's 6 months. April to call it September, that's 5.5 months. Remember, the first iPhone was released, or was announced in January and released in June.
Oh, that's a good point.
Because Apple had to, because it was going through the FCC for approval.
That's true.
That's the only reason we got to see that thing early.
Yeah, that's true. Sometimes it really annoys me when you're right.
Well, you know, I've still got that TV thing. That TV debacle.
That's true. Okay, now, but one thing that's different in this case is that instead of introducing a completely new product category, so there is nothing for people to stall on purchasing, we do have existing Apple TV. So,
well, true, and that's still at the hobby level. So if everyone stopped buying Apple TV immediately, it's not really going to hurt Apple all that much.
Yeah,
there I go with that being right thing again. But keep in mind that they could, within the parameters that Bloomberg's sources laid out, Apple could announce this device in April and ship it in June or May, or they could announce it in September and ship it in September or October. They could announce it as early as April or later, and they could release it as late as the holidays or earlier. There's a lot of room in between those.
Yeah, that's true. Now, okay, so with that parameter, I'm more okay with the time frames, because I'm seeing something where there's like a one quarter, whether it's a calendar quarter or fiscal quarter, it doesn't matter, but like a 3-month window where we have announcement to launch.
Sure.
I think it's going to be closer than 6 months.
It seems like it would be. And if it's not, it's only going to be because of the timing, again, for either regulatory approval or because they know it's going to leak otherwise. You know, there will be a reason for it, but it will probably be a narrow window. I totally agree with that.
Yeah, and I do believe part of that narrow window would be because even though Apple could stop selling Apple TV today and it wouldn't ruin their profits, I don't think they want to lose the momentum of sales. So they will try and find a way to continue to sell their $99 box for as long as they can until the new one comes out.
Yeah, probably.
And they may actually do it as a two-tier thing, where we have the basic Apple TV that we have today, and then the Apple TV Pro, or whatever they want to call it, Apple TV Theater, I don't know, that has the other set-top box features that make it function with cable company services.
Sure. That's true. Yeah, I would imagine they would go down to one device. But another interesting question, Jeff, is going to be: would they have different boxes for each cable service?
What I see is what you do with TiVo right now, where it's one box with cable card slots.
True, but you say that, and the DirecTV devices are DirecTV only.
There is that.
And so, ideally, of course, you would be able to choose which cable service you're working with through a menu. And as Apple adds more cable services in the future, you'd be able to, that would be handled through an update. That would be
right.
That would obviously be the best thing for us, the consumer. So, and I'm hoping they can end up doing that. But I'm really excited about this, and I can't wait to see what actually happens.
I'm excited too. And I just came up with another question that I can't answer. So maybe one of our listeners can. The cable cards that you get, say from Comcast, mm-hmm. are those the same cards, just like with different software on them, that you would get from say Time Warner?
They're making them to a standard, the cable card standard.
Okay, so if that's the case, then I could see where it would be much easier to design an Apple TV that has everything built in, no need to swap cable cards out. It's just a matter of selecting which service you're using, Time Warner, Comcast, whatever. And then if there are any special software bits that need to be downloaded for that specific provider, you have your internet connection, it downloads them, and you're done.
Yeah, that does actually seem likely.
That would be so Apple, where you don't have to wait and deal with your cable company to get a card to plug into your Apple TV so you can use it.
Right. Of course, you could just pull it out of your existing box for existing customers.
Sure. But you don't do that when you buy an iPhone.
It's true.
It's all there.
That's true. Apple's hands may be tied on the cable card issue. They may not. This actually, the cable card issue may be one of the things that's held up a new and improved Apple TV all this time.
Oh, that's possible.
We don't know.
No, if we did, well, we'd be telling you now.
You'd be the first to know.
And you right there.
You're right, exactly. Exactly. All right, we have a sponsor for today.
No kidding.
Who's
our sponsor, Brian?
Our sponsor is Squarespace, and they're doing something pretty cool for this week's show.
Squarespace is awesome. But wait, they're doing something special, you say?
I do. They are trying to recruit designers and engineers, and they're doing it in an insanely awesome way.
Oh, do tell. I hope it involves like big cities.
Why, Jeff? It does.
Golly, Brian.
They are going to invite the interviewee. So this will probably be someone who's gone through a pre-qualification process, because otherwise I would be Brian Chaffin, engineer. That would have been my title on this week's show. As a matter of fact, if I had been smart, that would have been my title on this week.
If you're going to be Brian Chaffin, engineer, uh-huh. it needs to be followed every time by woo, woo.
Can I be Brian Chaffin, designer, engineer? That's twice the chance of getting to do this. Anyway,
yes.
They're going to invite the interviewee and their spouse or partner to be New Yorkers for a weekend. Those are their words. So they're going to take people dining in, New York's fine dining establishments. They're going to put you up in a swanky hotel. They're going to take you out to live music. They're going to take you to modern art, and they're going to pay for the whole thing so that you can see what it would be like to be a New Yorker for a weekend.
That's really cool. It's and this is genius. All part of finding their new designers and engineers. That's really cool.
It is. You can go to be a part of it. Squarespace.com. Now we're going to have that note in the show notes. Actually, if you're listening to this, we have that note in the show notes.
Right. But and if you're a time traveler, we will do this next month.
We'll do it. We're going to do it after now. Because
right. Or before then.
Because timey-wimey is...
very wibbly-wobbly.
Exactly. So I just think this is the neatest little thing they're doing. I so wish I could convince them that I am an engineer or a designer. Because I want to be a New Yorker for a weekend on their dime.
Wouldn't that just be awesome?
It would be awesome. So
can I be your partner if
yes, why not?
Will talk, but that's okay.
That's
sweetie.
Okay. I'm completely okay with that, honey boo.
Oh, my cuddly little babushka.
So, by the way, Squarespace, we should probably just mention really short. Squarespace, they're a web hosting service where they've democratized great design. That was their goal, and I think they've done it. So these incredibly good-looking themes that are really flexible, and you know, they've got e-commerce. They can take money. You can sell physical goods, digital goods. You can do a blog. You can put your restaurant up, or a photographer. You can put your portfolio up. And they've got all these great-looking sites that you can harness to present yourself on the web, and the stuff looks fantastic. And
you don't need to know how to code.
And you don't need to know how to code. You don't need to know how to code, but if you do know how to code, you can actually tweak stuff. It's like the best of all worlds. So I love this company. I love what they're doing. And if you're an engineer or designer, go to beapartofit.squarespace.com. Cool stuff.
It sure is, baby.
You know what else is cool? In this case, literally. Sapphire glass.
Yeah, that is pretty
actually
cool.
Sapphire.
Yeah, so glass. But in this case, we're talking about synthetic sapphire. I've taken sapphire to calling it sapphire glass for some reason.
Yeah, I think that's why I typed that, because I was talking to you. But it's not glass, it's sapphire.
It's sapphire, yeah. Synthetic sapphire.
It is not glass. But we had a fantastic story from Mark Gurman over at 9to5 Mac. This is just a great piece of reporting.
Mark totally rocked it.
Yeah, he totally rocked it. We'll have a link in the show notes to their coverage, and then the analysis piece that I did, kind of looking at the implications of all this stuff. But what he did is he pieced together from a bunch of documentation, some of it leaked to him and some of it filed with the SEC, that says that GT Advanced, this is the Sapphire company that Apple is partnered with for part of its plant, part of its manufacturing space down in Arizona.
Mm-hmm.
And they have some 500 and, I don't know, 30 or 18 or something furnaces, these special built furnaces that make sapphire. And they've got another 400 and change on order for almost 1,000 total. And according it's a crazy amount. It is a crazy amount of sapphire production. And according to Mark, and the math and the documents, it would be enough to theoretically make 200 million iPhone-sized sapphire screens in a year.
That's
about what Apple does.
Yes. And based on all the research Mark did, this seems very, very plausible. And especially because he has legit documentation to back up a lot of what he's saying. So, yeah. But then we get these reports about how Apple's planning on using the Sapphire as the surface on the still-rumored iWatch, and that it won't be coming to the next iPhone because it's going to be cost-prohibitive.
Right. And that is where, to me, things get really interesting. Now, I thought from the beginning, when we first got this story out of Arizona about Apple partnering with GT Advanced to make Sapphire in Apple's plant with Apple's machinery. You know, Apple owns all these machines that have been bought. And when that first broke, I immediately went to the iWatch for this material, because of course sapphires are the that's the crystal on high-end watches today and has been for, 60, 70
years. A long
years.
Time.
Yeah. And so, that was always my assumption. And then other people started speculating, and I guess it's also used for Touch ID on the iPhone 5S.
Mm-hmm. And it's also used as the protective cover over the lens on the camera on the iPhone.
Right. Because Sapphire is so hard and clear. And there are people, though, who went with the notion that Apple was maybe looking at doing Sapphire to replace Gorilla Glass for the iPhone display. And
right.
It would be insanely cool if Apple could do this. And when you look at the volume of product that Apple can supposedly, or that GT Advance can produce exclusively for Apple with all of this machinery, iPhone seems reasonable.
Sure.
But then there's the story that you covered.
Right, where sources were talking about Apple going with the iWatch only for Sapphire. And I've come up with an idea about how both of these can be correct.
Okay.
Apple can't get every one of these Sapphire-producing gizmos at once. Even if they did, they can't get them all up and running at the same time initially. You have to phase equipment in. So maybe we will see Sapphire just for the wrist top thing that Apple's working on this year. And they will be ramping up their Sapphire production so that next year they can start using it as the material for the iPhone, which also gives Apple a lot of field test time to see if there's going to be any problems with their design before they scale it up to a bigger surface. Because they'll have all of us wearing iWatches.
Well, I like part of this and I don't like part of this. Certainly.
Well, this is where compromise comes in. It's an important part of a relationship, honey.
Yes, sweetie. We certainly don't know how. We know that Apple, according to the documentation that Mark Gurman uncovered, we know that GT Advanced and Apple have taken delivery on 500 and some odd units. Now that's enough for that's enough material for 100 million and change iPhone displays. And we don't know the schedule for the other machines. Maybe the other machines aren't supposed to be delivered for 2 years from now. We have no idea. All we know is that they're ordered. We also, as you said, we don't know exactly what Apple's schedule. Apple has enough money that it can buy enough capacity to meet its peak need and not worry about them not running the rest of the time. So, all right, they could leave X amount of these machines idle for as long as they wanted from a financial standpoint. And that works for GT and GT Advance because Apple is taking all the risk of buying these machines in the first place. Right? That's what Apple does with its money. It buys the manufacturing facilities, it buys the equipment, and then it hires the expert companies to actually run it. So, okay.
Yeah, so one of the benefits of actually owning all your own equipment, It gives you a little bit of flexibility in how you're using it.
Exactly. Of course, that means that GT Advanced also has to be flexible with its personnel, but that's another issue. Apple using Sapphire for a wrist-top device, by the way, that's the first time I've heard you say that, and I love it. It's a great term, wrist-top.
Thank you.
It makes sense for this thing to go on the iWatch before it goes on the iPhone. But my question is, why so much capacity? Because let's just look at the machinery that Apple has already taken delivery on. 100 million iPhone-sized displays, that probably translates into 200 to 300 million iWatches. I don't think Apple can sell 200 to 300 million iWatches in certainly the first year. Probably not ever.
Well, okay, here's another thing for us to think about. What if it's not one single product? What if Apple's going to roll out a line of wearables? And so they need the glass, the sapphire, for multiple types of devices.
Well, that's possible. I mean, you know, in some of we know for sure that some of that sapphire will end up going for more Touch ID covers and more more camera covers, including more camera covers on more devices, including the iPad, right? And including every future iPhone.
And the iPod Touch.
And the iPod Touch, yeah.
And so, if Apple adds Touch ID to all of those devices, that's a lot of home buttons that suddenly need Sapphire.
Yes, that is true. But God, you know, the amount of material used on a home button is just, you know, it's what, 4 or 5% of a reasonable. Now it's probably more like 10 or 15% of a reasonable size watch, and that a watch is 10 to 20% of the size of an iPhone.
Yeah,
it's actually probably smaller than that.
Which has me going back to Apple is not ramping up manufacturing with all of these magic little things as fast as they're getting them in.
Well, so let me actually play devil's advocate on my own point that Apple can afford to do that. One of the reasons why Apple can afford to do that is because Tim Cook is such a genius. Tim Cook and his team are such geniuses at managing logistics. And they are not going to waste hundreds of millions of dollars on machinery that they're going to need in 2 years. They're not going to set that up now. What, you know, wasting $10 or $20 million because they know that they're going to need it, and this is the absolute schedule that they have to go on. Sure, I can buy that, but I am confused as to what Apple needs all this capacity for, because I don't think it can sell enough iWatches to use it all.
Yeah, I have to agree. I mean, that is a metric buttload of watches. And I'm not trying to justify the notion that it's not going to be iPhones this year. I'm just tossing out ideas now. What if Apple, because GT can continue to make Sapphire for other companies too. What if Apple is planning on ramping up on their end, but they could get a sweet deal on all the equipment right now, even though it's more than they need for where they're going to be over the next 18 months?
That's a good point. Or maybe even the company that makes this equipment already was committed to already had their capacity 3 years out already committed.
Sure.
That's possible.
Yeah, okay. And so GT uses this equipment and is selling Sapphire to other people, and Apple's taking a cut because it's their equipment.
Well, one of the things... Well, yeah, that's certainly how that would work. But one of the things that Mark Gurman uncovered was an exclusivity commitment, where GT advanced... told the SEC that they are working exclusively.
Oh, I totally forgot about that.
For this stuff.
Well, toss that idea out the window then.
So yeah, it's really interesting. And of course, you know, there are other kinds of combinations. Apple could be looking at making one of the issues you mentioned this earlier, but one of the issues with using Sapphire as an iPhone display is the fact that it's going to be cost prohibitive. In other words, Apple has not yet figured out how to use Sapphire anywhere near as inexpensively as they can use Gorilla Glass. And I use inexpensively as a relative term.
Yeah, well, in this case, yes, definitely relative term.
So, and no one's done this before. To my knowledge, no one has used Sapphire material for any kind of cover, any kind of glass cover, any kind of crystal cover, whether glass is a bad word, on that size. And certainly no one has used Sapphire on a multi-touch gesture display.
Okay, so now we come into new territory.
Yeah, Apple's going to have to figure out how to do all this stuff. And cost is definitely a figure. So I don't have a problem with this, with the rumor that it's not going to be on the iPhone because of money. I don't have a problem with that rumor. That rumor actually makes sense to me. It's just I can't then justify, I can't balance the sheer Sapphire capacity that Apple is supposedly building, according to these documents that Mark Gurman found.
Yeah.
So it's fascinating.
It is fascinating. Yeah. Okay, here's another thing that I'm curious to see how it plays out. Will the surface space of Sapphire scale up well enough that it can reasonably be used as the surface for an iPhone? At the size of an iPhone, will it be too brittle to handle drops? And will they be able to produce this material at that size without any distortions, so that you don't have weird artifacts showing up on the screens, or it looks like part of the screen's out of focus?
I think we can actually jump right to an answer on this. I think that the mere fact that Apple has entered into this agreement with GT Advance,
the answer is probably yes. They've covered all that.
Yes.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Because you don't have to make this stuff yourself to be able to test it. It seems like the issue is money, not ability.
Okay, yep, I will go with that.
All right, listen, we are almost out of time, and I kind of want to mention Apple University. Are you okay with quickly jumping over to that?
Let's do that.
Apple University, we have a story. It's funny, Bloomberg, again, covered it from the standpoint of Apple promoted a woman. I don't have that story.
Satya Nadella. No, wait.
No. You're so funny.
Well, that's all I've got, man.
Please don't sue me, Alex Trevek. We are...
He wouldn't sue you. He has people for that.
Oh, yeah, fair enough. So we have... who? Denise Young-Smith. There we go. She was apparently working for... in the Human Resources Department. She has now been promoted to be the head of Apple's Worldwide Human Resources Organization. That was Bloomberg's story. And as a footnote, the reason why she was promoted is because... what's Mr. Podolny's first name? Joel Podolny was moved from heading human resources to, as a full-time gig, heading and expanding Apple University within Apple. But that, to me, is the actual story.
Yeah, that's the big news right there. Because what that says is that Apple is really serious about the whole Apple University project.
Right. And Apple University is fascinating to me because so what Apple University is supposed to do, and this is actually quoting
Satya Nadella.
Quoting the LA Times from 2011, where Joel Podolny is the man who worked with Steve Jobs to develop Apple University. He was the dean of Yale's Business School or Harvard? Yale's Business School. He was the dean of Yale's Business School. He came to Apple probably for a metric crap ton of money and worked with Steve Jobs to identify the tenets that Steve Jobs, quote, believed unleash innovation and sustain success at Apple. Those include accountability, attention to detail, perfectionism, simplicity, and secrecy. So the whole point of Apple University is to teach Apple executives Steve's vision of how to develop products and run a company. Right?
Right. And so now they have someone full time to manage that whole thing.
Manage and expand it. That was actually part of the story, was expanding Apple University. So on the one hand, you know, part of the story here is that Tim Cook is clearly committed to Apple University and is you know, making probably a major of you know, not relative to Apple, but relative to any other company, a major investment in doing so, in you know, running this program. And here's why I think that Apple University is so interesting. There are people who say Apple is nothing without Steve Jobs because Steve Jobs is everything. Right?
There are people that say that, yes.
We get that all the time, especially from mainstream pundits. And the proof in their pudding is that Apple hasn't disrupted a market since Steve Jobs died. And the timing on that, the timing on making conclusions based on that since Steve Jobs has been dead for 2 years and a couple of months is ridiculous.
Yeah, especially if you look at Apple's track record for how often they did disrupt markets when Steve Jobs was alive.
Right. But here's my real problem with that line of thinking. If you think that Steve Jobs was everything, you need to pay attention to the fact that Steve Jobs told Walter Isaacson that the thing he was most proud of having created is Apple. It's not the iPod, it's not the Mac, it's not the original Mac, it's not the Apple II, it's not the original Apple computer.
It's not the company itself.
It's the company itself. And he said that he told Walter Isaacson that he had worked very hard in the final years of, well, what became the final years of his life, to make sure that Apple could outlast him. Now, Apple University is a big part of that. Steve Jobs worked with Podolny to crystallize all the things that Steve Jobs thinks are important. Right. A lot of someone like Steve Jobs, like all of us, you know, the thing that we're really good at, we tend to be, you know, it tends to be something that, you know, that often operates at a gut level. And I think that was certainly the case for Steve Jobs. But he brought a business expert in and an education expert in to take that out of Steve Jobs' gut and actually codify it. And that's what Apple University is. And you, to me, it is completely irrational to say that Steve Jobs was everything and then to dismiss the fact that Steve Jobs said that he made sure that Apple could outlast him.
Yeah, there's an incongruency there.
There's a complete incongruency there. It's not quite how I said it before when we were talking about it before the show. But you can't believe one and dismiss the other without it being irrational. It is irrational to do so. And that's why I get so tense about people that talk about how Apple is doomed without Steve Jobs.
Well, a lot of these people also have said that Apple needs to license their operating system in years gone by.
And make cheap phones for market share sake.
Right. And yeah. So that's their mindset. And of course, they can justify in their minds that Apple is doomed because Steve is gone.
Right. And with respects to idiots everywhere, these people are idiots.
I shouldn't laugh. I only encourage you.
All right, we're over.
Yes. Yes, we most certainly are. But I know exactly how to fix that. And that's this week's Apple Context Machine. If you have anything to comment on, add, or question, write us at acm@macobserver.com. Thanks for listening. Feel free to follow me on Twitter and app.net. I am JGam at both places. And head on over to iTunes and rate our show for us, because we love it when you do that.
Indeed. You can follow me on Twitter, TM O'Brien. That's Brian with a Y. Our content is written by the good people at the Mac Observer. Our bandwidth is provided by Cashfly. The bass is by Boom, recorded just for us. And you can find me at geektales.com, and you can find Jeff at freshbrewedtales.com. That's all for this week.
Oh, and you just reminded me, if people are going to be in Denver on February 20th, I'm speaking at Ignite Denver.
Ooh.
about Fresh Brew Tales. I was supposed to do it last fall, but I was stranded in Estes Park because of the massive flooding. So come see me. February 20th, Ignite Denver.
Indeed.
Stay subscribed.
We'll see you online at the Mac Observer.
I love you, honey.